This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A day of terrorist attacks on the United States. Four commercial jetliners have crashed. Targets include the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Here's New Yorker Stanley Mises, who witnessed the attack in New York City.
I was sitting in my breakfast table when I heard this loud explosion. I ran downstairs and I saw smoke billowing out of the World Trade Center, and then just moments later, another hit, and I live close to a mile away from the Trade Center, and you could feel the heat. You could feel the heat right where I was standing, at least a mile away. It was unbelievable.
A day of terrorism. We'll bring you all of the news as it happens in depth from New York, from Washington, and from around the world. But first, this news update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The World Trade Center and the Pentagon were attacked this morning. Large passenger planes crashed into the two Trade Center buildings in New York City. Each of these collapsed. A third plane crashed into the Pentagon. President Bush says these attacks will not go unanswered.
Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
Heavy black smoke continues to pour out from what's left of the World Trade Towers in downtown Manhattan. Rescue operations are underway. The number of fatalities and injuries are uncertain at this point. NPR's Melissa Block is on the West Side Highway near the towers where rescue personnel are gathered.
There are thousands of emergency personnel who are waiting here. I believe there are a few that are down there, but they are keeping most of them at bay while they try to figure out how to get them in there safely. I've been talking with a number of the emergency personnel, some of whom are coated with ash and debris. They look like they are just caked in mud, who were down there. They responded quickly to the initial plane crashes, went down there, and then were there to see. Some of them saw people jumping out of the upper floors of the building, clinging to attaché cases in some instances, so panicked and fearful, and ultimately justifiably fearful that they would not survive, that they jumped out of the building, which was 110 stories tall.
NPR's Melissa Block reporting from New York. A fourth airplane crashed today outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That crash occurred as the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon were struck by large passenger planes. Mark Newtbar of member station WDUQ is near the crash site. He describes events surrounding the Pennsylvania incident.
Everything that we know at this point, it all began with a 911 call that came into the Pittsburgh Operations Center. That was shortly before 10 o'clock. It was someone who said that they were on this airplane and they were in the bathroom making this emergency call. They said that they had been hijacked. In the middle of that conversation, reportedly there was an explosion and the phone went dead. That was just before we started getting reports that there was an actual crash.
Mark Newtbar of member station WDUQ. Major League Baseball has postponed today's schedule. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig has delayed 15 games out of interests of security and deep national mourning. No decision has yet been made on tomorrow's games. Two U.S. Women's Soccer Cup games set for this evening in Columbus, Ohio, have also been postponed. Major League Soccer has put off all four games set for tomorrow. The PGA Tour has canceled the Thursday start of the World Golf Championship in St. Louis, the Tampa Bay Classic in Florida, and another tour event in Oregon. All national markets, financial markets, are closed. This is NPR. The Pentagon was the third building struck today by an apparent terror attack. NPR's Steve Inskeep is there. He says one part of the Defense Department used for coordination purposes is full of smoke.
We heard that the National Military Command Center itself had filled with smoke after the explosion. There were different reports about whether they were forced to evacuate, but the latest information we have from a Pentagon spokesman is that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is, in fact, there, and other officials are there, and from that location, they continue working and continuing to try to evaluate information and decide what to do.
NPR's Steve Inskeep. Some victims of the Pentagon crash are being taken to local area hospitals. NPR's Allison Aubrey is standing by with more.
I'm standing
standing just outside the emergency room entrance of the George Washington Hospital in the District of Columbia. The medical director here has just briefed reporters. The hospital has admitted and is treating two victims rushed here from the Pentagon. Both are in stable condition. The patients are a mother and her infant child. The mother is being treated for a concussion. The infant has slight injuries. The hospital has called in extra surgeons and staff as they are expecting more victims from the Pentagon. It's reported that paramedics have only just recently arrived on the scene at the Pentagon, and transportation to the hospital is slowed by absolute gridlock in the streets of Washington. The hospital is also reporting evacuation of its academic center adjacent to the hospital due to a bomb threat. All employees working in that building have been sent home. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
The three apparent terror attacks have also resulted in the grounding of the nation's air traffic. All air traffic around the country has been halted until further notice. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, supporting the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations to help save the lives of children. GatesFoundation.org.
This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Again, four airliners were hijacked at U.S. airports today. Three of them crashed into targets. They can only be described as targets of terrorism. Two into the World Trade Center in New York, one into the Pentagon outside of Washington, D.C. The fourth plane crashed in a wooded area of western Pennsylvania. We're not exactly sure as yet that it is connected to the other three incidents, but at this juncture, it seems likely. Casualty estimates are as yet unavailable, but they are clearly very high. We're going to go right now to Dr. Robert Labenson, who is the director of the emergency department at St. Clair's Hospital in Manhattan. And doctor, first of all, thank you for joining us. I know you must be very busy.
Yes, my pleasure.
Can you describe what's going on there at St. Clair's?
We're quite busy, seeing, I'd say, maybe 2 to 3 times our normal volume.
Which would be? How many more?
I'd say we're seeing approximately 8 or 9 patients an hour, when we would normally be seeing 3 to 4 patients an hour.
And are these are from the World Trade Center?
Many of them are from the World Trade Center, and some of them are also collateral issues related to the events at the World Trade Center.
People hit by debris and that sort of thing?
No, responses in the community that are chaotic, causing people to fall, some emotional issues, medical illnesses that are coming as a consequence of the emotional distress.
Now, is St. Clair's, if memory serves, is in Midtown?
Yes, we're on 52nd Street between 9th and 10th.
And this, obviously, a fair distance away from downtown Manhattan, where the events happened today. But I assume there has been citywide planning for such contingencies?
Yes, we're part of the New York City disaster response. There's an incident command system that is controlled by the city through the EMS or 911 service.
And again, this is just an assumption. I'm assuming you are on the phone with somebody or the radio saying, we can take so-and-so many per hour or so-and-so many more.
Yes, we would frequently get telephone calls about what our ability is to handle patients.
And are you conducting triage?
Yes.
And have there been fatalities?
Not at St. Clair's yet.
Well, we can all be grateful for that. I know you're very busy. We thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Robert Labenson, the director of the emergency department at St. Clair's Hospital in Manhattan. And NPR's Peter Kenyon steps in now. And Peter, one of the things in terms of new news as we've been going through the day has been the discussion of an apparent 911 call that might have come from one of the aircraft. What do you know about that?
We're seeing reports on some of the wire services about the crash that took place in Pennsylvania. The reports are that an emergency dispatcher got a call from a person who said that they were locked in the bathroom of the plane, and the quote was, "We've been hijacked, we've been hijacked," and the caller repeatedly said, "This is not a hoax, it's not a hoax." There's not much more than that so far, but it clearly would seem to indicate that fourth plane was, in fact, a part of this pattern of terrorism. The Latest reports are all 45 aboard that flight are in fact dead. That's according to emergency officials in the area. They say they have no verification of any survivors. Beyond that, there were 65 people on another United Airlines flight, and there were a total of 156 people on the two American Airlines flights. And we're still trying to figure out which planes actually hit the World Trade Center. It could now be that it was one American and one United plane, but we're still sorting that out. As you can imagine, it's all a bit chaotic. But there are those numbers of people who could all be casualties. And then, of course, the most horrific number could come from the World Trade Center itself, where some 50,000 people will be at work, tens of thousands of people visit every day. So those numbers are still yet to be seen.
President Bush has issued a couple of statements during the day, all very defiant. First person to describe this as an apparent terrorist attack.
Yes, and then after he landed at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, he said freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended. The president went on to say that the American people should make no mistake. The United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts. And he said he asked the American people to join him in prayer for the victims and the families. Clearly, there will be a large response to this. I think you've already got a sense of the waves of anger and shock that are emanating from this all around the country and around Europe and other parts of the world. It remains to be seen where those will be focused, but clearly there's going to be some reaction.
And though the attack on the Pentagon obviously caused tremendous damage, and again, we fear tremendous numbers of casualties, we were hearing that the National Military Command Center, the place from which all of these operations would be assessed and mounted, that is operational.
Yes, of course, the first place to coordinate a lot of those things would have been the Pentagon, but there are contingency plans for an event just such as this, and officials say those are in place, and the government is running just fine, and all the leaders are safe and making decisions. There's not many details on where they are. That's just a matter of security. There's a lot of speculation now on who may have been responsible for this. The Taliban out in Afghanistan, the group that gave shelter to Osama bin Laden, quickly came out and condemned the attack and said that as far as it was concerned, Mr. bin Laden and his group had nothing to do with it. There has since been one report on the Reuters wire service quoting an American official as saying there are some signs that the Al-Qaeda organization, Mr. bin Laden's organization, may have been involved, but even that official said it's premature to make a firm conclusion on that. Obviously, that will be one of the most intensive focuses of this investigation after they deal with the rescue, the search and rescue operation.
Some ancillary effects include the shutdown of the entire air traffic system. Every plane airborne has been recalled to the ground. There are still a few en route from places like Europe. We heard earlier from Marianne Akers, our correspondent in Chicago. Those would obviously be permitted to land, though I think they're being diverted to Canada. But Canadian flights have been interrupted as well. Stock markets are closed, that sort of thing.
That's right. Most international flights have been diverted to Canada. Few are being allowed to land in the U.S. now, depending on where they were. Clearly, there have been many scenarios over the years of so-called convenience terrorism, where infrastructures and communications are disrupted. And obviously, this doesn't fall into that category because it was a very violent, destructive act of terrorism. But the ancillary effects, as you said, the secondary effects are all in that category of no one can get through on cell phones and the planes are stopped, traffic is stopped. Wall Street is shut down, is expecting a dismal opening tomorrow. The European markets have suffered similarly. So clearly there are going to be very large monetary and other effects from this.
Peter Kenyon, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil. And
Peter's been briefing us throughout the day. Let me now introduce our guests who are with us. Philip Wilcox, the former ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department during the Clinton administration. He is with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me, Neil.
And also with us, Dr. Gerald Post, a professor of political psychology and international affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., an expert on international terrorism. And thank you, sir, for joining us.
My pleasure.
First of all, Philip Wilcox, you must be thinking today of your colleagues and what they are doing. What can you tell us about the first kind of response to an incident like this, though, of course, there's never been an incident like this?
The first response must be to attend to the wounded, promptly restore order and infrastructure, and undertake immediate security measures to guard against yet another sequential attack by the same group. That should be the absolute focus and priority of U.S. government efforts now, while simultaneously the search begins for the culprits.
And Dr. Post, can you describe, I know that one of the things that you have been doing and one of the things that will puzzle many of our listeners is how people can pursue their what appear to be political goals with such fanaticism as to kill so many people. And I know that you've been in the Middle East speaking with people about that very issue.
Yes, we're just wrapping up final stages of a project where, kind of an unprecedented project, where we have interviewed some 35 incarcerated Middle Eastern terrorists, both secular and Islamist terrorists. And what is quite remarkable is that these are not emotionally disturbed individuals. And we're really talking not about an individual aberration, but about being caught up in a very powerful social movement. For the radical Islamists, the mosque has served as a very powerful rallying force. The terrorist, one of the terrorists who bombed our embassy in Tanzania, I had the opportunity of interviewing for some 15 hours in connection with the trial that just concluded in New York. And his life was meaningless except when he was doing something for the besieged Muslim victims. And then he felt very important and didn't even know what he was fully doing, in fact, but it was something with a sense of belonging and of contributing for his people.
And again, this is a study that Dr. Post was conducting of terrorists who happen to be Middle Eastern terrorists. We do not know yet who is behind today's coordinated attacks, but Ambassador Wilcox, any doubt in your mind that this was a calculated, coordinated attack on the United States?
No, it has all the marks of a very sophisticated, large-scale, well-organized, professional terrorist operation of unprecedented scale and sophistication, exceeding even the many scenarios that the U.S. counterterrorism community works on.
Dr. Post was mentioning just a moment ago the day that bombs went off, coordinated attacks on embassies of the United States in Eastern Africa. That, I guess, was the first suggestion that this kind of coordination was conceivable.
Yes, that was indeed also well coordinated, although far less sophisticated and immense than this catastrophe.
Can you give us an idea of the level of logistical and financial organization that must have been responsible for this?
Well, the logistics required communication among a great many people, including, I would suspect, people here in the United States, if these were indeed foreign terrorists, to hijack four aircraft and to target these buildings would have required enormous knowledge and planning. It may well be that the pilots in these aircraft were disabled and that the terrorists took over and actually flew the airplanes, which is another astonishing and novel a precedent in this amazing act.
Given your experience, this would have taken how long to plan and execute?
I would think it would take many months to put such a plan together and to deploy people in the right places and to carry this off in such a synchronized manner.
And one cannot help but ask, the United States has considerable intelligence resources that are arrayed to detect just such events, as you suggest, coordination with individuals in this country and abroad possibly was involved. There would seem to be a lot of ways to find that out.
There will doubtless be questions and charges about intelligence failure. But remember that intelligence can only do so much. The United States cannot be omniscient. We do not have the means nor the ability, indeed, nor the will to try to know everything. And this is where the terrorists have the advantage. They can strike by surprise. Perhaps we should review our intelligence, although we've made a massive investment in intelligence. We have a good intelligence there is always the possibility of planning such acts that can never be detected by the means that we have available.
Yes, it really emphasizes, here we are as the world's leading superpower with really incredible technological and intelligence capabilities. However, what you're talking about here is the need for human intelligence, and the ability to penetrate these groups is extremely, extremely hard, and we can really never, in our busy-blooming confusion of a democracy, ever guard fully and protect against small groups of individuals planning clandestinely such attacks without ending up in becoming a terrorist state ourselves. That's part of the dilemma.
That is Dr. Gerald Post, a professor of political psychology and international affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He will be with us through the remainder of this hour, along with us Philip Wilcox, a former ambassador-at-large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department during the Clinton administration, as we continue to follow the horrible and shocking events of the day that began with attacks on the World Trade Center. Two aircraft crashed into them in Lower Manhattan. Later, another attack at the Pentagon. A fourth plane has also crashed. This is a special report from NPR News. This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We continue to follow developments following the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington earlier today, the hijack of four American airliners, all of which have crashed with all of their passengers and crew aboard. However, that seems to be likely the tip of an iceberg of immense dimensions as casualties figures begin to come in from New York City and from the Pentagon. NPR Steve Inskeep has been out at the Pentagon or near the Pentagon with us earlier today. Steve, can you bring us up to date?
Yes, I can, Neil. I'm looking at the area where the airliner struck the Pentagon. The smoke, some of it anyway, has now begun to clear, and you can now clearly see a cross-section of the building where that airliner smashed in, and I really can't compare it to anything I've seen except perhaps the Oklahoma City bombing, if you can imagine that. Now, we are getting some information, better information, about what is happening inside the building, and some of that information is not as disastrous as it might otherwise be. First off, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, we are told, is on duty along with other senior Pentagon officials in what is called the National Military Command Center. That is essentially the place where top military officials will go in order to coordinate the response to an attack like this. We were told by a Pentagon spokesman earlier in the day that that center had itself filled with smoke and had to be evacuated. We're now told that although it was smoky in there, that they're back in there and working again. The second piece of information that we have, Neil, is that we're told that the section of the building where the airliner hit was under renovation. The Pentagon itself has been going under a renovation for quite some time, and that may affect the ultimate casualty figures because you can at least hope. You can hope that because that part of the building was under renovation, that perhaps not as many people were in that section of the building as previously thought. That said, though, Neil, it is clear that there was an extremely broad fire, extreme heat. We could see for a while flames that spread perhaps a third of the way along this wall of this immense building. We do have reports of casualties, but we have no idea, no official figures as to how severe.
And are the triage operations that we've been hearing some doctors describe from emergency rooms in New York and from other parts of Manhattan, are those still continuing on the grounds outside the Pentagon?
That's correct. We have, in effect, a kind of field hospital set up in front of the area where the plane struck. I can, in fact, see tents that appear to have been pitched, although I'm some distance away. There's a great number of ambulances. And in between where I'm standing and the Pentagon itself, we have a broad field, and a number of helicopters have been coming and going. Some of those with the Red Cross on the side, medevac, military helicopters, some of the most severe cases to other locations. So we have treatment here, and we have treatment elsewhere.
Steve, I know you've got many other things to do, but can you give us any idea of the response of the people in that area, the military people and some of the civilians who work at the Pentagon?
Yes, I can, Neil. I think it's been in some ways remarkable. People have remained relatively calm throughout this instance. I spoke to an Army Lieutenant Colonel earlier today who was not very far from where the explosion took place, and he says that they were simply sitting there watching actually the news from the World Trade Center in New York City when they felt the explosion strike this building. And he says what happened was that several soldiers and members of other military services got together and went directly toward the source of the fire, trying to find people and bring them out. They said the heat was so intense that they did not succeed. I've heard stories from other people of military personnel going into that area and pulling people alive out of some of the rubble, out of the wreckage. And so people have done a remarkable job, I think, of staying calm and doing the best they can under those circumstances. That said, though, Neil, I should add that over the last several hours, there have been a number of false alarms here. Periodically for a while, I think as many as three times, we had reports of another plane approaching the area, and military personnel and civilians who were outside the building were told to get away, and some people were seeking shelter. In the end, the only aircraft that have passed over have been friendly, so to speak, a couple of Air National Guard F-16 fighter jets, which, to be honest, I was happy to see, and also some helicopters.
Steve, we know that at the White House, for example, in emergency situations, they're supposed to send people up to the roof equipped with, I think, Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. Was there any similar kind of system to protect the Pentagon? And if there was, what happened?
You know, we've been asking that question, Neil, and we don't have a good answer exactly what sort of defenses were up and ready in this situation. Certainly during different times of heightened security, there have been people with anti-aircraft missiles on the roof of the Pentagon, but we have no information as to whether that was the situation today. Told now that this area is on the highest state of military readiness possible, which is perfectly understandable, but I do not know what the state of readiness was earlier this morning.
Are they describing that as DEFCON 5?
I believe they're having a different phrase for it, Delta. Threat condition.
Okay, that's different from DEFCON 5, which means war. Okay,
that's
an important distinction. Thank you very much, NPR's Steve Inskeep, and he will be back in touch with us, I'm sure, from the Pentagon later today as more information comes in. And again, here in the studio with me is Philip Wilcox, a former ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. And on the line with us, Dr. Gerald Post, a professor of political psychology and international affairs at GW University here in Washington, D.C. And again, Dr. Post, you've been recently interviewing 35 imprisoned terrorists in the Middle East. Again, this is not to draw a conclusion that the terrorist incidents in the United States today were inspired by events in the Middle East, but talking about terrorists. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is what is their reaction when they see another of their colleagues, so to speak, carry out an action?
Well, it's one of exultation, often. And if anything, this magnifies for them their wish also to be carrying out such acts. It's a kind of almost social contagion that that can occur. You may have heard earlier of the Palestinians in the street in the occupied territories celebrating this, and among them will be some youth in particular who this may tip the balance in terms of their moving into one of the terrorist groups.
Philip Wilcox, one of your jobs as a counterterrorism expert was to monitor those groups as they built and developed. Has there been any effective means to crack into terrorist cells and disrupt them?
It's extraordinarily difficult to place human agents inside terrorist cells, particularly terrorist cells in the world of militant extremist Islam. The language, the cultural barriers are so great that it's extraordinarily difficult to do. We do rely, therefore, heavily on technical means of intelligence. Obviously, we need both.
And before skimming over that, intercepting phone calls, satellite reconnaissance, that sort of thing.
But yes, that sort of thing is very important, and we do that. It is no less important for the U.S. government in all of its presences abroad to engage with foreign societies to understand their dynamics, their politics, their languages. It is not just gathering secret intelligence. It is getting a deep sense and understanding of what makes those societies tick and what the pathologies are in those societies so that we can deal with those in other ways before they express themselves in terrorist acts.
Dr. Post, I wonder, you've been looking into the psychology of people who do engage in terrorism. What do you find that they have a insight into our psychology? Do they do the same thing?
Well, there's a tendency to, for many of the terrorists, have certainly never met an American, don't really, and have had conveyed to them a rather stereotyped and exaggerated view of the unbelieving supporters of Zionists, etc., etc., etc. It's and in particular, they are really encouraged to be joining the struggle to defend Muslim victims.
What do you think that some of the people that you talk to, would they see this as simply striking a blow or something that would be designed to change American behavior?
Probably both. On the one hand, I think it's worth emphasizing that earlier in the history of terrorism, almost all acts had responsibility claimed for them. Now, only some 40% of acts of terrorism in general have responsibility claimed. And one of the reasons for that is that there's been an increase in extremist terrorism from religious groups. And if, in contrast to more conventional earthbound terrorists, if you will, who are trying to influence a conventional audience, a government, international opinion, we have with the radical Islamists a wish to expel secular modernizing influences. And more importantly, their audience is God, and God doesn't need a New York Times headline or a story in the ABC Evening News.
Ambassador Wilcox, as you listen to this, clearly, I'm sure you're looking at it in terms of the counter-terrorist aspects of it, but you also have to look at it in terms of American response. And one of the difficulties of an American response has been often the inability to find clear fingerprints. Who actually did this? And that's just what Professor Post was, Dr. Post was talking about.
It is more and more difficult today because in the past decade, most acts of terrorism have been carried out by non-state terrorists rather than agents of governments. It is much easier to monitor and track the activities of governments to bring pressures and sanctions to bear against governments who might be tempted to use terrorism than it is to deal with these non-state actors. They're an amorphous, in chaos group of people, a great challenge for our intelligence community.
Earlier, we did hear a report of one U.S. official saying that the group led by Osama bin Laden might have been involved in today's attacks. Can you, without speculating as to whether he was involved or not. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? Again, this is one of those characters who comes up in news stories, and we always act as if everybody knows who Osama bin Laden is.
Osama bin Laden was one of many children of a wealthy Saudi contractor who became involved in a militant Islam and went to take part in the Mujahideen War in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. He became enraged by the dependence of his government on American troops during the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and its threat to Saudi Arabia, demanded the expulsion of all foreign troops from Saudi Arabia as an insult to Saudi Arabia, as an assault on Islam. He is a deviant, pathological figure. He does have wide influence in the world of Islamist extremism. I can't speculate on whether he was behind this or not, but
Again, a lot of people. I'm sorry, Dr. Post?
Well, just to note a couple of things. One of the changes that occurred, and he's been, it is his funding that has supported many of the camps in Afghanistan, where earlier, up through 1997, the goal that Ambassador Wilcox just spoke of was the preeminent goal, expelling foreign troops, particularly U.S. troops, from sacred Saudi Arabia, the guardian of the holy shrines. However, in 1998, he issued, well, one can't really use fatwa because he really isn't a religious leader, but the equivalent of a pronouncement that there is no distinction now to be made between military and civilians, and that Americans were a target anywhere because all Americans supported their government, and their government is the enemy of Islam. So it's a really quite significant shift that occurred. And he's become identified in many ways. He's given a number of media interviews as kind of the number one terrorist of the moment, and has seemed to thrive on this attention.
And the testimony at the trial of those involved in the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa would appear to leave little doubt that he was responsible there.
Oh, yes, that is assuredly true, although interestingly, there's a two-tiered organization. There were the planners, older, more senior strategists, and then recruiting non-members of al-Qaeda to actually carry out their acts. It was quite interesting. And finding vulnerable individuals in the mosques, sending them off for training, and that being their almost rite of passage if they ultimately join the group. So the action precedes being a member of the group.
Okay, hang with us. We're going to go now with to Chicago and NPR's Murad Abid. Are you there, Rod?
I'm here, Neil.
We heard earlier today from Steve Inskeep that there have been any number of scares and alarms near the Pentagon following the attack there earlier today. Can you tell us what's been going on in Chicago?
Well, sure. Let me just give you a chronology of my morning. On the bus this morning heading into downtown, this was about a half an hour after the initial plane crashes at the World Trade Center, and I was the only person who had a headphone radio, and people were certainly asking, what had happened, what was going on, but it was pretty calm, and they just sort of wondered about the news. I went to my office on the Navy Pier, and it still pretty much looked like a normal morning here in Chicago, but I have to admit that as I was walking down the lake, you would turn around and look back at Hancock and Sears, and just turn around and look at them, sort of very aware of them.
The two tower buildings.
Yeah. Yes, the tallest building in the United States, and the other one of the other two major towers here in Chicago. About an hour later, I left the Navy Pier to head for the NPR Chicago Bureau, which is right in the middle of the Chicago Loop, the downtown area. And this was after the towers had collapsed and after the Pentagon had been hit, and also after they had evacuated those two towers, the Sears Tower and the Hancock. And the tenor had changed. For starters, the pier, which is a huge tourist attraction, was surrounded by police. Sirens were blaring all over the city. Nothing had happened here, but sirens were blaring all over the city. And I got on another bus, and you could tell the people were very upset. One woman was screaming. She was screaming about the government and how could they let this happen. Another woman broke in and started yelling that this was phase one, to quote. And another woman said she was heading to the grocery store to stock up. From there, I went to a Radio Shack to buy some equipment, and there was a long line, about 8 people, buying batteries, buying cell phone equipment, buying AM, FM radios. One man in his 40s was telling another man that his son is, quote, almost draft age. He wondered if he should take him to Canada. And that's the thing. If you walk the streets of Chicago, you know, 900 miles from, 600 miles from Washington, 900 miles from New York, let's say, you know, it's pretty normal out there. It's a little more crowded. There's a little more traffic. But as you walk, you catch pieces of conversation, and there really is only one topic being discussed today here in Chicago.
The buildings there, the tall buildings, have they been emptied?
They have been emptied, and there was absolutely no, as far as we know, no threat to them as far as we know yet. But that's the thing. I think that anybody who was in downtown Chicago after seeing a 1,350-foot buildings collapse couldn't help but look up and around at our 80 and 100-story buildings and wonder. And that's the other difference today, of course, right now. If, you know, usually the skies over Chicago are full of planes holding to land at Chicago's O'Hare and Chicago's Midway Airport, and the skies over Chicago, like every city in the U.S., they're empty today.
Rod Abid, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Rod Abid, NPR producer, who's speaking with us from our bureau in Chicago. We're going to be continuing live coverage throughout the afternoon, the evening, and the night right here on NPR. With us for the remainder of the hour are Philip Wilcox, a former ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department during the Clinton administration, and Dr. Gerald Post, a professor of political psychology and international affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. We will bring you up to date as events develop following the attacks earlier today. Briefly, 2 attacks on the World Trade Center in New York. Both towers have collapsed. And then after that, another commercial airliner that had been hijacked flew into and crashed into the Pentagon. A 4th airliner crashed in Pennsylvania. I'm Neil Conan, and this is a special report from NPR News. NPR News will provide special coverage throughout the day and night to keep you informed of today's events, events President Bush has described as an apparent terrorist attack. We'll continue here in Studio 3A until 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Then Noah Adams, Linda Wertheimer, and Robert Siegel will continue today's news coverage of the events. NPR News will provide special news coverage throughout the day and night. This is NPR News. This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A item now from the Federal Aviation Administration, which has announced that all the aircraft not involved in the 4 hijacks today have been reported to be safely on the ground as of this afternoon. Between 40 and 50 scheduled flights landed at various American airports, leaving no domestic airliners in U.S. airspace. That, according to the FAA, that puts to rest fears that more aircraft may have been hijacked and could be involved in subsequent attacks. At least today, there were fewer than 22 U.S.-bound flights from international locations still in the air that are being given clearance to land at various airports in North America. In an unprecedented move Tuesday morning, the FAA issued its first ever national grounding of commercial aircraft following the attacks on the World Trade Center in downtown New York City and the Pentagon outside of Washington, D.C. Military and law enforcement flights are still flying. The FAA would not confirm the extent of military air traffic in commercial airspace. That is the latest news that we have. With me in the studio, Philip Wilcox, a former ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. That was during the Clinton administration. And Dr. Gerald Post is on the line with us. He is an expert on international terrorism, a professor of political psychology and international affairs at George Washington University. Excuse me there. And first of all, Dr. Post, you have done extensive, you've been involved with profiles of people involved in terrorism, and lately, as we've been discussing these interviews that you've done with terrorists who are being held in prison, has time in jail and the extent of debriefing, I'm sure you weren't the first person to speak to these individuals, has that changed their attitude at all, do you think?
Well, that's one of the most striking findings of our study. I would say, yes, it has changed it. It has deepened it. It has strengthened it. Their stature within the organization has been enhanced, and it's almost a check mark on the curriculum vitae to be noted. And it has not changed in any way, led them to doubt what they did. If anything, they feel rewarded. Moreover, a number of them are actively involved in leadership and leadership decision-making. So it isn't that they are not in contact with their people outside of the prisons.
Let us go now to Philadelphia, where we're joined by Terry Gross, the host of NPR's Fresh Air. Terry, an awful day.
An awful day. Neil, on days like today, I think we all run through the list of who we know and we wonder how they are. One of the many people I wondered about this morning was Roger Cohn. I've interviewed him several times about life in a war zone. He covered the war in the Balkans for the New York Times. Today, he became the acting foreign editor of the Times. I'm sure that he figured his new position in Manhattan would be out of harm's way. I called him a little earlier to ask about the shock of seeing terrorist attacks destroy the World Trade Center towers in his new hometown.
Well, this is my first day on the job, actually, Terry, and I think, like everyone, one's in a state of shock. I just dropped my son at school this morning and was down by the water, the East River in Brooklyn Heights, and somebody shouted at me, the World Trade Center's on fire. I looked up and saw smoke billowing into the sky and papers, presumably from banks or law firms or whatever, just floating out over the East River. It was a harrowing sight. I then turned the corner, and at that moment, the ground shook as this second explosion occurred when the second plane went into the midriff of the second tower, which I believe is now the one that's collapsed. I hurried to a subway and came to work. There were a couple of women sobbing on the subway, one of whom was worried about her brother and who spoke to me. Somebody else said it's like a movie, which I found to be an intriguing and curious reaction. These things do happen in reality, as I've seen in my own life and career, but certainly didn't expect it to happen here. And now we're just fanning out here and trying to cover this terrible event as comprehensively and movingly as possible.
I guess I'm wondering if it's different for you watching this massive terrorism in New York than it's been watching people from other countries engaged in war.
It is different. I can't say my mind went immediately back to Sarajevo or something like that. Manhattan right now is cut off in the way that Bosnian capital was during the years that I covered it. But obviously this is a city on a scale and with a symbolism that goes far beyond that of Sarajevo. Just the notion that this kind of attack can be carried out, that seemingly several planes can be hijacked simultaneously, is profoundly shocking.
Roger Cohn is the new acting foreign editor of the New York Times. Another person I wondered about today is William Langevisha. He's a pilot of small planes who has written eloquently about flight. He's a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. I wanted to know what he's been thinking today as he considers the two airplanes that crashed into and destroyed the World Trade Center.
The first thought is that airplanes are so easy to fly that this is very hard to fight against. I, of course, was not, none of us know at this stage what happened in the cockpits, but it seems just instinctively obvious to me that the pilots of those airplanes were incapacitated one way or another, and that somebody else slid into the seat, took the controls, and did this. The problem is that it wouldn't take much of a pilot, let's say terrorist pilot, to do this. Once an airplane, an airliner is airborne, it's almost instinctively obvious how to fly it. So to steer it into a large target is not difficult.
Why do you think that the real pilots were disabled and somebody else took over? Maybe there was a gun to the pilot's head.
Even with a gun to the pilot's head, I find it hard to imagine that this could have happened because if the choice would be very obvious, and I think that we would all choose death rather than this. We would all choose the gun rather than the building.
You're certain that a real trained pilot couldn't pilot a passenger plane into a building, knowing that it would be destroying the building, the people in the building, and killing the people on the plane. What would the pilot's alternative be if there's, say, a gun to his head?
A last-minute turn. It's at the point where it's obvious that this is what's happening, and that may come, it may have come, we don't know, fairly late, maybe very late, maybe only a few seconds before impact, that is what these people were after. It only takes a second to turn an airplane, and a violent maneuver of one kind or another at the very last second is what I would expect any pilot would perform, and that would also have the additional effect of incapacitating anybody else, anybody standing behind him with a gun.
And the plane might end up crashing.
Right, but not necessarily into the target. So it's so easy. It is as easy to steer an airplane away from a target as it is to steer it into the target. So if an airplane hits a target, we can presume that those who were in control were those who wanted it to hit the target. I think the weather was good. These buildings were very visible.
You've written the cover story for the October issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. It's called Peace is Hell. What do you mean by that?
It's the story of the discomfort that the U.S. Army has in peacetime. Specifically, it's about the peacekeeping mission in Bosnia and the problems that this has posed for the Army. Does it relate to today's events? Yeah, it does, and the problem is that is what I call the Goliath syndrome. I mean, the real question is, of course, how do we react? We are this great, powerful society. We are this great, powerful military, and how do we handle ourselves in a world that is so much smaller than we are? In the case of Bosnia, how do we handle ourselves in a peacekeeping mission in a very small and obscure part of the world? It's very difficult to do, and in the case of today's events. How do we react? Who do we go looking for? And beyond that, how do we handle that person or those people once we find them? And the problem is really that we have all of these, you could say, cannons, but they're too big for the targets, and we may not even be able to point low enough for the targets. And this is part of what I'm writing about in the October issue.
Talk about more how that applies to any actions that the United States will try to take against whoever's responsible for today's acts of terrorism.
Well, it's pretty clear that whoever is responsible for today's acts, that whatever group is responsible, is a very small group, probably well organized and very small. So we have this enormous apparatus of security and military, and we really can't bring all of it or even a large portion of it to bear. What we have to do, obviously, is somehow get down to the same level as our opponents in this case in order to deal with the situation. It is the classic problem of asymmetric warfare.
You fly a lot. You're a pilot. You've also been writing a lot about issues of national security. Are you panicked by today's events? I mean, how are you emotionally reacting to it?
I think, like many Americans, I'm shocked by it. Certainly not panicked, and I also have a strong feeling about that I think has been proved through the history of this country that the United States manages more than any other country to pull itself together and respond in a healthy way. Our response here to what has happened today is the really critical issue now in the weeks or months to come. And not only the question is, of course, not only how do we respond internationally, how do we go after the people who have done this, but how do we respond internally? Everything from airport security to air traffic control, laws, all of these things. How deeply into the fabric of American society do we let this go? We obviously have to respond. But I would say that the great genius of the American people has always been the sanity of the response to a crisis like this. And I have, therefore, I'm not at all panicked. I have huge faith in the United States.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
William Langevisha is a pilot and a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. I'm Terry Gross. Neil, back to you.
Terry Gross, the host of NPR's Fresh Air, speaking with us from Philadelphia. Thank you very much. Ambassador Wilcox, as we were listening to that last conversation, I saw you nodding in agreement as several points were made, particularly the one perhaps about having cannons that were very large but maybe pointed at the wrong targets.
That's quite true. We must respond, and we will, but we should do so deliberately and carefully and wisely. Our domestic response, as William Langevisha says, is very important. We must not exaggerate the problem as enormous as it is. The terrorists' main objective is to create fear beyond the maiming and killing of people. And if we were to react in a panicky way and to undertake excessive measures that would cripple our society, that would compound the victory of the terrorists. I don't believe we will, but there will be those voices which will demand drastic measures to absolutely prevent further acts of this kind. We cannot gain that kind of absolute certainty. If we did, we would paralyze our society and undermine the freedoms, which are more important than anything else.
Dr. Post, an improper U.S. government response might build on the events of the day, but surely the terrorists, at least in your experience, would you say that they believe they have already succeeded?
Oh, absolutely. This is a cause for celebration. I think it's worthwhile emphasizing one other thing in terms of American considerations. There was a hearing even today on, in fact, preparing for and responding to weapons of mass destruction terrorism, focusing on chemical biological terrorism in particular. This event should emphasize to us that mass destruction can be brought about through conventional weapons, as indeed all of the most dramatic terrorist acts have occurred with, now we have planes flying into buildings, but also truck bombs and car bombs. The embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the earlier attacks on the Trade Center Tower buildings, the domestic terrorism attack on Oklahoma City. So resources really need to be directed in terms of intelligence, in terms of psychological measures. One cannot counter a war for people's minds with Delta forces. And we really need to be, in some ways, in my judgment, redirecting our efforts away from exotic terrorism to this more conventional terrorism.
Dr. Post, thank you very much. We're running out of time in this hour. We wanted to thank you and, of course, Ambassador Philip Wilcox, who's been here in the studio with us in Studio 3A. We will continue our coverage as events continue. I'm Neil Conan, and this is a special report from NPR News. NPR News will provide special coverage throughout the day and night to keep you informed on today's events, events President Bush has described as an apparent terrorist attack. We'll continue here in Studio 3A until 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Then Noah Adams, Linda Wertheimer, and Robert Siegel will continue news coverage of today's events. NPR News will provide special news coverage throughout the day and the night. This is NPR News.